I'm expecting measure.
Welcome back to the Reinvent Health podcast. In today's show, I chat with the fabulous Dr. Mark Opperman about all things hormones, how to balance hormones as we age, when things go wrong, what to do about it, as well as how our lifestyles can make or break us. Dr. Mark is a regular guest on the home channel's Real Health and has a weekly health segment on Cliff Central. Please go to the show link to find Dr. Mark's contact details and website link. If you enjoy this episode, please share it with your friends, colleagues, and family. And don't forget to subscribe and leave a review. This helps me to reach a wider audience. Enjoy. So Dr. Mark Opperman, thank you so much for joining me on the Reinvent Health podcast today. I'm so thrilled to have you here because hormones are so topical and something that's really misunderstood. And I'm hoping we can demystify a lot of the misconceptions about hormones as we age.
Nikki, thank you. It's such a pleasure to join you. And yes, I think when we look at hormones, most people, when they hear the word hormone, think of menopause in women. Mm-hmm. And men, when they hear the word hormones, think about their wives. Exactly. You know, but we tend to forget that we have 50 hormones in the body. And just like an orchestra, each of them represents an instrument. Now, if they go out of tune or out of rhythm or sync with one another, the piece of music that you listen to is no longer a symphony. It starts sounding like a cacophony. Uh-huh. And that's what we deal with hormones on a daily basis, specifically in women.
Sure. And I think, you know, most people will come see you when they're really feeling awful, when the sex drive is non-existent, when they can't lose weight, when their hair is falling out. We tend to wait until everything's falling apart before we start thinking about, you know, long-term effects of not looking after ourselves. So just for the sake of those listening, give us an idea of, you know, what you see in your practice on a daily basis and who's coming to see you and for what.
You know what, Nikki, actually the tendency is changing. We used to see women going into the menopausal period from the age of 50, but It's starting sooner and sooner than one would be expecting. So for both men and women, we are in our prime in our 20s. And from the age of 28, things start changing, specifically for men. If we, for instance, look at testosterone levels, male testosterone levels peak around 24 and they start decreasing from 28.
Yeah.
What women don't realize is that their estrogen comes from testosterone. You make more testosterone in the ovaries because it's the testosterone that then goes on to form estrogen. Now, testosterone level starts declining in women from the age of 20.
Yeah.
And by the time that you get to 50, your testosterone levels have declined by 20%. So, you know, it's far sooner than one would actually think. And, you know, as I said, all these things are linked to one another. So when one starts declining, it opens the doors and causes avenues and stimulations and inhibitions of other hormones.
Yes.
So you start throwing out the cascade from a very young age, actually.
Yeah. And we are seeing this earlier and earlier. And I think, you know, a lot of this has got to do with stress, not managing stress.
Absolutely.
You know, we don't have the community support and the connections we should have as a species. People are not looking after their health as they should. And let's really focus on, there's so many things that we could talk about today, but let's talk about why we should be optimizing hormones as we age. I always say to people that if nature had its way, that it'd be done with us by the age of 43 because we can't technically procreate anymore. And then purely on a species level, there's no need for us. So everything declines and we are heading, you know, one direction to sort of falling apart. But we don't have to do that.
I love what you said there for one simple reason. And I explain this to my patients every single time with every consultation. Mm-hmm. Our biological lifespan is 38 years.
That's right.
So, you know, but the only mammals that live longer than us are elephants and whales.
Yeah.
But through the advancements in medicine, we've extended our life expectancy.
Exactly.
But we haven't changed our physiology and our biology. And that is what changes. And the changes in hormones are what lead to the diseases of aging. And here we think about cardiovascular health, like hypertension, cholesterol levels. We think about our glucose and insulin metabolism, cholesterol, et cetera, et cetera. So you start getting heart attacks and strokes and diabetes and cancer and cognitive decline and bone loss, which leads to immobility. And that ultimately would have killed you if you were living in the wild, if it wasn't for how we change the way that we live.
Exactly.
So yes, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, I do agree with you. At the age of 43, you should actually be dead.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, telling somebody in their early 20s or mid-20s that they should be actually thinking about their mortality and should be thinking about how they, you know, optimize their hormones is like trying to sell life insurance to a child. They don't understand mortality. Yeah. You can't even imagine what it would feel like to wake up in the morning with a backache because it's not part of your, you know, it's not how you made up at that point. And probably at that point in your life, your hormones are thriving. So what should we do? And for those listening who are interested in being vital, healthy, happy 80-year-olds, 90-year-olds, what should we be doing in our mid-20s to make sure that we increase the quality of life or our lifespan going forward?
You know what? Here we need to look at lifestyle and the lifestyle interventions. You know what? It's very interesting that if we look at World Health Organization's recommendations for physical activity. For adults, physical activity can be 150 minutes per week.
Yeah.
But for children, it's at least an hour of physical activity per day. Sure. And you know what? So many of us, as we enter the work life situation, you sit behind the desk, you go home, you're tired, you maybe watch a bit of TV, you play a video game. So, you know, but where entertainment and physical activity went hand in hand, and that downtime, this has changed to a more sedentary kind of relaxation. And I think that's definitely number one.
Couldn't agree more.
Number two, diet. And here you are the expert. We see that the foods, et cetera, that we are consuming are inflammatory, they're high in salts and sugars and fats, and that contribute to hormonal instability because I either overstimulate a system, and that leads to problems, or I don't stimulate it at all. And the one that I think is something that no one ever can escape unless you live a very cushy lifestyle on a tropical island where you're part of the locals and there's enough food for you to go and pick and fish. You know what? Stress is what ultimately kills us.
Let's just, you know, just focus on that for a little bit because, you know, lack of movement is, it's, somebody said it was as dangerous as smoking, and I completely agree because it affects our brains and our bodies. But let's just dive into how body composition, specifically metabolic syndrome or elevated glucose insulin levels, directly affect our hormones and how that leads to infertility. I mean, if you look at the average, and I'm really generalizing here, but the average 30-year-old South African male, they have got an overhanging gut. They do not look well. And this is directly connected to alcohol consumption, consumption of processed foods. And with that comes low testosterone levels. So, you know, how are these things all connected? How does the hormone insulin impact our ability to make those sex hormones?
You know what? What we need to understand is that insulin is a pro-inflammatory hormone. And I don't think people actually understand what insulin does. So I always, when I talk about energy metabolism, I refer to someone that all of us have become very familiar with, and that's Eskom. So if you think about Eskom and how they generate power, it's they need fuel, and the fuel is, your coal. Now, the fuel for the body is what you put into your mouth. And the fuel that we are referring to here is glucose. Now, glucose comes from carbohydrates. And I think at some point, you should enlighten us a bit about good carbohydrates and bad carbohydrates. Now, those carbohydrates breaks down into the building block, which is glucose. Now, glucose circulates in the bloodstream, but it's useless there. Actually, it's quite dangerous if it's just in the bloodstream, because fuel needs to get to the power station. For it to get there, you need a transport system.
Yeah.
So let's just take a look at what is happening at our ports. You know what? A little while ago, we all heard about all these trucks that are standing at the ports and they can't get the coal to transport it, blah, blah, blah. Now, if you have too much glucose in your system, your transport system, your insulin needs to work harder. Now, suddenly you're going to produce more and more vehicles. Now, all of us know that if you drive on the N3 or the N2 or N1 to Durban, your biggest complaint is that, oh my God, there's so many trucks on the road. And what do those trucks do? Number one, they hold up traffic.
Exactly that.
And number two, they damage the road system. And this is what insulin does. Now, the way in which it connects to your sex hormones is that insulin, being a pro-inflammatory hormone, is going to elevate cortisol levels. Cortisol is the hormone that regulates your blood sugar. And cortisol, if it elevates in conjunction with things like stress and inactivity, now starts down-regulating the rest of your hormone systems. And in particular, when it comes to your sex hormones, it elevates estrogen levels. Now, estrogen comes from testosterone. So think about it logically. If I have enough estrogen, the body is going to say, you don't need to make more. So you're going to start switching off the system. So you are going to stop making testosterone. And therefore, testosterone levels starts decreasing. Our lifestyle, all the plastics around us, the pesticides, et cetera, when they break down in the body, they are called xenoestrogens. And they mimic the structure of estrogen and further down regulate everything. Now, the first sign of testosterone decrease in men most probably is a decrease in libido and sex drive with low erectile functioning and that middle age spread that we all dread. And I cannot tell you how many younger guys, and here I'm talking 28 to 38, sitting in my practice with erectile dysfunction or with a low sperm count. And this is directly related to what is happening in the other hormone systems.
And, you know, so often when you get a woman coming to you because they can't get pregnant, and they've been for all the tests and they've done all the prodding and poking, no one's gone and asked the partner, the husband, the boyfriend, you know, what's going on your side. And invariably, these guys have got low sperm count, low testosterone, they are insulin resistant, but nobody looks at the other half of the, you know, the recipe here. And it is a growing issue. But then also we're seeing this in younger children. So I'm seeing young girls age 8 and 9 who've started menstruating, and the moms are like, why does this happen so soon? And it's just what you've said. These children are more sedentary than they should be. They're not getting an hour of high intensity movement in every day. They're consuming way too much glucose. They're drinking Energade. And they stress. These children are stressing, and we're wondering why we are seeing, you know, kids with elevated hip to waist ratio and elevated levels of estrogen so early. And this becomes disease later on in life. You know, this is so, so dangerous.
Absolutely. You know what, when we look at the incidence of overweight and obesity and children under the age of five,
terrifying.
The statistics are shocking.
Yeah.
And this is because of the processed food that these kids are exposed to. Now, if we look at the children from 5 to 18, 40% of children are overweight and 13% of those children are obese. Now, 10, 20, or let's make it 20 years ago when, you know what, you didn't see
no,
this.
No, you didn't.
Children were out on their bikes, they were playing outside, they had imagination, and they were far healthier. Now, obesity in childhood is definitely associated with a higher incidence of metabolic disease, like you said earlier, and we can discuss that at some point. But metabolic disease leads to a change in your lipid metabolism. It leads to cardiovascular disease, higher incidence of diabetes, and cancer.
Yes.
Now, think about how many new cases of cancer we are starting to see in people younger than 50, which is unheard of. Cancer is an age-related disease.
Yes.
Why? Because the breakdown of your DNA due to environmental factors. Now, we are exposing younger and younger people to this without proper repair mechanisms. So obesity in children, a nightmare.
Yeah.
And it's something that can be prevented. You know what? And here, you really have to put blame on government.
Yes.
Food industry, and directly to the parents.
Parents are doing their best, but we are, I'd say, largely misled by, I'm sorry to say, the food industry. We do things and buy things for our kids that we assume are healthy, and they're really not. And this is because I think it's a social issue. You know, we assume we don't make time. We don't make time for what's important. Everybody is rushed off their feet. Both parents are often nowadays having to work. So that family dynamic and sort of the structure where we can create better choices for our families is diminishing. It's diminishing rapidly. And this is a massive issue. So just to change or sort of scoot sideways, on this very topic, you know, often when we see young kids come into the practice with these hormone issues, they've often been to see a doctor, like a gynae, or the mom takes them to see a doctor or a gynae because they're overweight, they're breaking out with acne at the age of 10, they're menstruating, and the doc puts them on a contraceptive pill. In your opinion and your experience, what are the shortcomings and the benefits of a contraceptive pill right through, you know, whether you're 20 or 30 or 40, but what are the shortcomings of that for young people? Where is it causing problems?
So, you know, what there was a very interesting study and article that was published recently on the use of contraceptives and mental health. And, you know, what we saw that contraceptives play a role in depression and anxiety in children. I'm going to stick my neck out here and tell you what we are seeing in our practice. You know, what we see on average about three or four women per day. And as we go through the consultations with them, I always focus on a menstrual history and, you know, a contraceptive history as well. Certain of our contraceptives, and for this discussion, I won't mention them, but certain of the contraceptives definitely creates estrogen suppression. Most of these pills are a combination of a low dose estrogen and sometimes a little bit of progesterone. But by doing that, you suppress the body's natural ability to produce these things. So actually, you're suppressing ovarian function.
So you're putting yourself into menopause early, basically.
Yeah, these patients present with a clinical as well as biochemical picture of menopause, that we see it total estrogen levels, or E2 levels, we call it estradiol, below 48 when they're on a contraceptive tablet. So, you know what, I'm you know what, contraceptives work if they are used for the correct reason. I wouldn't put someone on a contraceptive to manage their acne. I wouldn't put someone on a contraceptive unless there's a specific reason that we have to manage the menstrual cycle for one simple reason. In the long run, you know what, these, in my experience, in any case, in practice, is that they cause problems later on in life.
And do you think they play a part in fertility issues? Or would you say that it really depends on the person?
I think it depends more on the person than the actual medication. But what I can tell you, which we are also seeing, is we're seeing a steady and quite a rapid increase in the prevalence of polycystic ovarian syndrome, which is related to insulin metabolism in these young girls.
Yes.
And that causes or can lead to a form of secondary infertility. Secondary infertility is where it's difficult. You ovulate, you produce eggs, et cetera, but you know what, the eggs aren't that healthy, or there's a problem with too many follicles, et cetera, et cetera. The metabolic pathways are disturbed, and then you battle falling pregnant. So I definitely see an increase in that in practice. Yeah.
So that makes complete sense. Yeah. So just to flash forward then, to sort of go on as we're aging, I'm also seeing an increasing number of couples in their 60s and 70s who are coming to me and saying, well, you know, they really want to do something about their sex drive, about their libido. They, you know, the mind is willing, the body isn't cooperating. Are you seeing more and more of this? And I suppose branching off from that question is really, you know, is it safe to replace hormones as we age?
You know what? You were talking about the 50 and the 60-year-olds. I'm, in my practice, I'm seeing it from the age of 30 onwards, and it's alarming.
That is alarming.
Very alarming. to be honest. I think when it comes to hormone replacement therapy, you need to make a differentiation. When I do public speaking, I always say to people, show of hands, who's taking any hormone replacement? And this we refer to specifically as menopausal hormone replacement. So this is your estrogens and your progesterones. And then I carry on and I say to them, okay, keep your hand up. Who is taking thyroid medication? And then a couple more hands go up. And then I say, who's taking anything like glucophage or metformin? And more hands go up. And then, the ones that people tend to forget is through COVID, everyone took vitamin D. Vitamin D is a hormone. So, suddenly the whole room's hands up. And what people don't understand is hormone replacement therapy is not just estrogen and progesterone and testosterone. It's all the other stuff. It's like when the safety of hormone replacement or hormone optimization therapy comes in, and I use the analogy of baking a cake. If you have an award-winning cake recipe, like you do in your 20s, the moment that you start changing one ingredient, that cake is not the same anymore. So it's about restoring balance when you do hormone replacement therapy. You can't just give one hormone as part of a cascade because it's going to suppress the other hormones or it's going to stimulate other hormones. So when you do this, you need to think about optimal balancing of hormone systems to maintain physiological function as well as the balance. So in my practice, I never refer to hormone replacement therapy. I always refer to hormone balancing. And when you get
I love that.
that right, you don't have side effects.
Yes, exactly.
So it's, and it's actually starts with not just for hormones, it starts with a lifestyle.
Yeah, it does. It always goes back to how we're doing life.
I think one of the things that people forget is that hormones are not only produced by your gut, but they're also metabolized in the gut. And those metabolites have effects. They have effects on the brain, they have effects on other systems. And lo and behold, they have an effect on your microbiome, the organisms that live in your gut. And therefore, when you, if you want to do hormone balancing or optimization or even replacement therapy, you cannot just look at that one system. You can't just look at the estrogen. You need to look at the overall holistic picture. So it needs to be a holistic approach. And I think in practice, and here I'm referring specifically to medical practice, that's often where things go wrong. I think you see so many people in your practice as a nutritionist where they tell you, yeah, but I'm on hormone replacement therapy and they promise me that this is going to change and that's going to change. And actually, it's just making everything worse. And that's because the balance is being disturbed instead of rebalanced to promote optimal physiological balance.
Yes, you can't fix one system without fixing all of them or neglecting one of them. It's never going to work. And that's what makes, I guess that's what makes it tricky because, the normal doctor is either a super specialist or a super generalist, but isn't really trained or doesn't have the time to work through all these systems with everybody because it takes a lot of work and time, as you know.
You know what? I always equate it to walking a tightrope in the dark. You know what? In the one hand, you're opening an open umbrella, and the other hand, you're holding a dumbbell. So you're completely off balance. And just to make it even more difficult, it's in the dark, and someone is playing around with the rope. The time issue is definitely a factor for one simple reason. The moment that I start with any kind of hormone, I bring about change in the body that only the patient experience. So you cannot go and take a look at the hormone levels on a blood test and change it according to that and let the patient come back 6 months later. From the first injection, from the first tablet or patch that you are using, things are going to start to change. So, you know, you need to be able to adapt your protocol to how the patient is reacting. There is no cookie cutter that would fit
that.
One patient to the other one. Every single one is different.
Oh, couldn't
and
agree more.
That is where the problem comes in. Why hormone replacement therapy is difficult and incredibly time consuming.
Yes, yes. And that being able to adapt your protocol and change your mind and do what that patient needs in the moment is the key. And that's where the
yes, you know, but it requires constant feedback from the patient.
Yes.
For instance, in my practice, when we start with hormone treatments, the patient is in contact with us once a week, either telephonically or, you know, at face-to-face, because we need to understand what our treatment is doing to the patient, because it can actually make them feel worse.
Yeah.
And you either have to support them through that process and say, you know what, this is normal. You're supposed to be feeling this. Or, oops, you know what, this is not working for you. We need to think of something else.
And I think that's really important, is to know that this is a system that needs to be adjusted and fine-tuned to fit everyone specifically. It's not like you're taking a Disprin and your headache goes away. This is something that's very unique to every individual, because we're so unique. I mean, it's like a fingerprint. And, you know, and I love that you check in so often, because that's when you can really make a difference in people's lives.
Nikki, I think one of the things that people tend to forget is, you know, when you're on hormone treatment, your environment and your lifestyle has a very big role to play in how your treatment is functioning. And that changes over time. So, you know, for instance, when we look at menopausal treatment, when someone goes into menopause or into the perimenopausal period, the estrogen requirements differ to that 5 years later. So, you know, so many times we see patients that has been given a prescription and may stay on that prescription for years with, you know, decreased efficacy of the treatment itself. So, you know, it is a constant adjustment, just like you have to change your diet.
Yes.
Your body's requirements for hormones and the interactions with one another change constantly.
Oh, completely. And I always say that to people, is that what's going on in your life that, you know, that an eating protocol worked last year, but it isn't working this year? What's happening this year? You know, how is the environment different? Because we've always got to adjust for these things. And I mean, that's why diets don't work long term, is because it doesn't take that into account. And you know, that's the signature for personalized healthcare.
Absolutely. I think this is where we start moving away from normal Western medication or allopathic treatments to functional treatment. You want to function optimally in the boardroom, in the bedroom, on the sports field. And, you know, your environment changes constantly, like you said. So you need to be able to adapt. And I think this is where we fall short in Western medicine. And functional medicine and preventative medicine is going to be where all of us will be focusing on in the next, I would say, less than 10 years time. It's going to be preventing diseases of aging. It's not treating them. It's far easier and far cheaper to prevent something than it is to treat it.
In your opinion, I mean, I'm sure you're seeing, and I know you are because we chatted about this last week, is increasing incidence of mental health issues, whether it's anxiety, depression, PTSD, but the symptoms are coming out more and more. People are not coping. You know, we know this is environment. We know this is based largely on circumstance, but where do hormones play a role in what we're seeing as increased levels of dementia, depression, anxiety?
So it's that decrease in certain hormones and neurotransmitters. And just to break it down, both hormones and neurotransmitters are chemical messengers. The only difference is that the neurotransmitter work over a very short distance, for instance, between nerve cells in the brain. And your hormones are made by specific tissue in one part of the body, and then it needs to circulate through your bloodstream to another part, and there they have to bind to receptors. So lifestyle and our environment, with it being stress, with it being diet, with it being activity, affects how those hormone systems balance and interact with one another. If we look at the most common mental health issues, you know, if we're looking at depression and anxiety, sleep here plays an incredible important role. So just think about what happens when you stress or overwork. You don't sleep properly. And the moment that you don't sleep properly, the body starts producing cortisol at higher levels. And that cortisol now pushes up your blood pressure. It pushes up your blood glucose levels. It creates dysfunction in your lipid metabolism. And that leads to changes in the other hormone systems. So testosterone that starts decreasing leads to less production and stimulation of dopamine in your brain. Serotonin comes out of your gut. So so often, you know, what you think about, I just need some comfort food. And what's comfort food? Comfort food are the food that make us feel better. It's what your mother gave you when you were a child, when you were sick, or when there was a celebration, and it was always something sweet or salty or something like that. And that changes your microbiome, which produces your serotonin levels, the feel-good hormone. Now, let's just think about what happens when you have a piece of chocolate or a piece of cake to feel better. It stimulates dopamine in the brain. But you know what? That change is so much related to hormone systems and neurotransmitters that the incidence of these diseases are skyrocketing. We spoke about it last week, how nutrition, for instance, affect mood. And you are the expert on this. One of the things that you told me, which I didn't know, is, you know, just how seed oils, for instance, have an effect on inflammation, and that inflammation has an effect on your neurotransmitter, specifically serotonin, which leads to anxiety, depression, ADD, et cetera, in children.
So, you know, this has been a really, really in-depth and fascinating discussion. And I'm sure anyone listening is thinking, well, what now? Aside from making an appointment to come and see you, which I hope many, many people listening will do, what is the, in your opinion, the one or two simple things we can all start doing right now to turn this tide around and start, you know, looking after our health span in terms of hormone optimization? What are the simple hacks?
You know what, Nikki, but those simple things are the most difficult things to incorporate. And that's the problem. It's be physically active. I tell my patients, take up a team sport, paddle, soccer, basketball, anything that you do with other people, for two simple reasons. It allows you the physical activity that your body needs, and it allows you time to de-stress and, you know, associate and interact with other people. So it goes a long way to managing stress.
Yeah.
Optimal sleep. If you wake up in the morning and you are not refreshed, you need to ask two questions. Did I get enough sleep? In other words, did I get 7 to 8 hours of sleep? So I don't manage that. I manage about 6 hours of sleep per night. And if you get enough sleep and you still wake up in the morning, ask the question, it's not the amount of sleep, it must be the quality of sleep. So what's keeping me awake? So it's changing the sleep environment and it's creating a good sleep routine.
Yes.
Diet is incredibly important. Stay away from the inflammatory foods. And with this, I'm going to defer to you. You know the inflammatory foods like your sugars, your salts, and your fats. And then it's actively managed stress. And I think that is the thing that no one is doing because we feel we don't have time. Take your smoothie because we're not allowed to have too much coffee. But I would say take your morning coffee. Go sit outside and actively listen to the sounds around you. Or go in the evening, go and get into a beautiful warm bubble bath or take a nice long shower and focus on sound, whether it's music, et cetera, so that you don't hear the voices in your head. That needs to happen. I didn't do that. I'm angry at that one. Drown out the noise. So simple, be physically active, have a good diet, sleep well, and manage your stress by becoming quiet in your own mind.
Yeah, and all of this is asking you to just be present, even if it's for 30 seconds, is just to be in the moment, which is so healthy for your brain.
Absolutely. And, you know, but those things actually, to be physically active, to sleep properly, and to become quiet costs nothing. And all of us can do that, and all of us should. Put it in your diary, because all of us now are working to a time schedule. Put it in your diary and for 10 minutes, twice a day, just take the time for yourself and declutter. Yeah. It's if you look at those TV programs, you know, at Hoarders, et cetera, that's what happens in your brain with stress.
Exactly.
We accumulate it. And if you don't clean it out, someday the stuff is going to fall on you and crush you.
It is. And putting it in your diary is important. I put all my exercise sessions in my diary. Otherwise, they don't happen. But if they're there, they happen. And it is, you know, and it is for free. That's, I think we just don't put value on things that cost us nothing. We'd rather spend a fortune and hope to get some return on investment where the most important fundamentals actually cost you nothing. And that's probably one of the most important messages here.
I can't agree with you more than that. And for parents out there, expose your kids to hobbies. You know, but whether it's creating a food garden where you grow simple stuff, carrots, beets, lettuce, it takes them out to teach them about healthy food. And, you know, it limit the time that they are sitting glued to some kind of screen. And limit your own screen time as an adult.
And this all plays a part in optimizing your health and hormones. So, Dr. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today. This was a wonderful conversation. And I'm hoping, I'm going to invite people listening to send questions in, because we can talk at length about so many topics around hormones. So send in questions. I'm sure we'll, find a gap really soon to answer all those questions for you, because I think keeping the conversation going is really important. And that's the way we start healing. And this is all part of being part of a community.
Absolutely. You cannot do this on your own. You need support.
Yes, you do. Thank you so much for your time today. I can't wait to get this out there. And I will put all of your contact details and, you know, social media handles in the show notes so anyone listening can get hold of you at any time and come and see you.
Nikki, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. I really do appreciate that. And I'm looking forward to our next one.